Fellowship meal tonight.
There I go. Magic. Lord willing, my family and all of us will be back tomorrow. Appreciate your hospitality so far, your encouraging words, and I hope that this meeting so far has been a blessing to you. This is a passage that I really appreciate for many reasons. It's a part of arguably the greatest sermon ever preached, and in that Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says often, "You've heard that it is said, but I say to you." If you'll read through Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, you'll see that he says that several times. And what Jesus was doing, he was really illuminating the truths of God in contrast to the teaching of the religious leaders of his day. And so when I read the Sermon on the Mount, I want to keep in mind that first of all, he's speaking to his fellow countrymen, the Jews. And so how they would have understood what he had to say is very important. Otherwise, we just remove the entire context and aim and purpose of what he was saying. And so when he says to them that they are the salt of the earth, they likely had in mind passages that they heard from the law, from Leviticus, one being where Moses said, "In every offering of your grain offering you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all offerings you shall offer salt." So not only was this reference to them being the salt of the earth, not only did it have to do with who they should have been in the greater whole of society, but it also would have been a reminder of the covenant that they were bound by God with. It was a covenant that Moses referenced as one of salt. And that was Leviticus chapter 2, verse 13 that I read a moment ago. Another passage, Numbers 18, verse 19, Moses again uses similar language in Numbers 18, verse 19. And he says, "All the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel shall offer to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants with you." So the whole reference to salt and to the Jews being the salt of the earth had a lot to do with their special covenant relationship with God. And so when they heard Jesus say that, they likely would have been reminded of the offerings that they brought before the Lord at the temple, how it was to be offered with salt, and how they were bound by God in a covenant of salt, as Moses referenced it. And of course, a lot of times we go on and we talk about the purposes that salt serves. Two of them mainly being, well, first of all, it adds flavor. There are just some things, if you don't put salt on, they don't taste very good at all. But be careful lest you reach for the salt first thing and offend the cook, right? So you always want to try it first. But secondly, salt is a preservative. Back before we had the great grocery stores that we have with all these nice aisles, and I tell you, I get so lost when I go in the grocery. I know, you know, I wish they would put the milk right in the front door, because a lot of times that's all I need. But they make me walk all the way across the entire store. Now, they do that so that hopefully I'll pick up something else and buy it, I'm guessing. But anyway, you don't care about my disdain of shopping. When I think about the Jews being the salt of the earth, I think about the context of the first century. They lived in Judea, obviously, but they were under Roman rule. Roman sovereign rule. They had within sight the hall of Pilate, or the house of the governor. And they would have seen Roman soldiers quite often. And you know, they were in the midst of their own homeland, but their own homeland was almost unrecognizable because it was occupied by foreigners who they just didn't want there. Now, if you draw a modern parallel, we're not occupied by an opposing force, thankfully. But many of us can remember decades ago that the country that we lived in was vastly different from the country we now live in. I was given an assignment to speak in a summer series this year, and I really think the preacher hated me because he said, "Stephen, I want you to talk about how we as Christians can talk to people who are having what he called transgender identity issues, those who believe that they're homosexual and things of that sort. I said, Tom, why me? Right? I mean, Bart, you wouldn't want to talk about that, would you? I mean, I may get you to sub for me. But, you know, I think, and, you know, I would have never thought that I would have needed to ever make a lesson along those lines. And then you probably have kept up with the news and you've seen that a great large retailer has one minute said that if a person identifies as transgender, they can go into any bathroom they want. And as soon as I heard that, I said, there is going to be a rise in assaults because a lot of daddies and husbands are not going to cotton. That's what my dad used. They're not going to cotton to a man going in a women's restroom. And going to be a lot of issues from that. Some of you that have been alive much longer than I, you're looking and you're going, man, I remember when we used to pray in school, when we used to say the Pledge of Allegiance in school, when we had memory verses in school. We're not talking about private Christian schools. We're talking about public schools. And so I think sometimes that we find ourselves in a hostile environment. Same country, same state, same place, but things are changing. But I want you to know that the environment we find ourselves in is no different or any more harsh or unkind towards our faith than that of the first century. We still have it relatively easy. Luckily, we don't have to worry about men storming through these doors, disrupting this meeting tonight, carrying us off and crucifying us, burning us at the stake, or setting us in a coliseum and letting a bunch of wild beasts loose on us. We still have it pretty good. I know things probably aren't what we'd like them to be, but here's what I believe. Maybe I'm just an optimist, but I fully believe that the things that we're seeing today is a wonderful opportunity for us as Christians to be the salt of the earth and to let our light shine. Because I'm going to tell you something, the light shines the brightest when it's most dark. I really believe that. And I know a lot of times Christians get all upset about things, and folks, I want to tell you, they bother me too. You know, I think about my children growing up, and my grandfather thinks about me, and he thinks about his great-grandchildren and the world that they're going to inherit. And so people say, you know, we need to leave a better country for our children. I want to turn that around and say, we need to leave better children for our country. That's just First Stephen. But while we are in this society, we can, without compromising our beliefs and what we hold so dear in our Christianity, can still be salt and light. And I'm going to tell you something. The world needs good, God-fearing Christians in it. Without the good, God-fearing Christians, how will the world ever come to know the love of Christ, the mercy that He offers, and the total transformation that He can make out of a person? We have a task before us. So let me set before you from the Bible a similar story. Three examples from this story. Find in your Bibles the book of Daniel, please. When I think about society and I think about hostile environments, I always think about Daniel. Daniel, when you get to chapter 1, you find out that the king is calling for some of the king's descendants of Israel and some of the nobles. Young men. So Daniel wasn't just, you know, a country farmer like many of us. He was born a descendant of a king or from a family of nobility. He's from good stock, as they say. He and his friends, who are named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego by the Babylonians. And so when Daniel and his friends are taken, they are probably around the age of 14, give or take a little bit. They're given a 3-year education according to the way of the Chaldeans. 3 years, they got a bachelor's degree in all the astrology, the theory, the religious literature, and so forth of the Chaldeans. These are Jews receiving a secular education, and I want you to notice what we find in Daniel 1, verse 4. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Now I want to stop, and here's what I want to get to you about. We could look at that, and sometimes Christians do this. They look at things such as this, and we go, you know what, in the bigger scheme of things, It's really a small matter. It's just a diet, after all. It is just a diet. Okay? Why not eat the king's meat? Why not drink the king's wine? Well, first of all, the likely answer to that is that whatever meat was offered had been sacrificed to one of the idols. And the drink that was offered had likely been poured in libation to one of the idols. So to partake of the king's meat and also of his wine would be partaking in an idolatrous meal. What we have to understand about that time period, they did not eat steak and potatoes for every meal. The only time they ate meat is when an animal was slaughtered, and pretty much the only time an animal was slaughtered was to appease or to worship their gods. So by extension, to eat this meat, to drink this wine, is to participate in a form of idolatry. And Daniel said, I'm not going to do it. But I want you to notice how he goes about it. Picking up where I left off, therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Daniel doesn't stand up. He doesn't say, I'm a Jew, I fear God, I'm not eating your pagan meat. He doesn't do that. He doesn't get a sign and stand out and say, I'm protesting. He doesn't say, I'm boycotting. He says, requesting, can I not be forced to eat this? Would it be all right if I had, instead of this, vegetables and water? He held true to his belief. He also did not make a scene of himself. But he very kindly requested. And you know, one of the things that you pick up, or at least that I've picked up with Daniel, is if you read through the first few chapters, he never demands, he never reviles when he's faced with this. He's very kind in trying to get his way. What society needs from us is strong convictions, yes. But society also needs us to be kind about our strong convictions. I can stand firm in opposing something, but I can be kind about it. I don't have to be hateful. You know, a lot of the whippings I got when I was a kid from my mother, here was the rationale. Son, it's not what you said, it's how you said it. Right? She wasn't disagreeing with the point, but it was how I said it. Apparently, I was what? A smart aleck. I don't know what an aleck is, but apparently there's something. I'll have to look that up in the dictionary. It wasn't what you said, but it was how you said it. My grandmother, my late grandmother I told you about in our last meeting, she used to always say, son, you can always catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar. So their purpose in telling me this wasn't to tell me that I needed to change my mind so much. I just needed to change my approach. You can have conviction. You can stand for your conviction, and you can be nice about it. You know what the world doesn't expect? It's kindness. You go to some of these places where these folks are making a protest or making a scene about something, they are going to do everything they can to bait you into acting how we shouldn't act. And then they're going to point the finger at you and say, oh, you're supposed to be a Christian? Look at how you're acting. So Daniel very kindly requests not to defile himself. Now, again, it's a diet. It's a little thing. But I'm going to tell you something. When you start letting the little things go, you'll let the big things go before too long. Compromise never begins as something grand and big. It always begins with the small things. I can honestly say, as much as I know, I have never known of an affair to begin just all out as an affair. It usually begins with a glance or a touch or a word or a smile. And that snowball, as long as it keeps rolling, it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it turns into what it should never have become. Daniel said, you know what? A part of the Jewish identity is to eat a certain diet and to not eat certain things. And on something so small, Daniel said, I will not give way. And in him not giving way, he requested. He never demanded. There's one for you. The second, I would say, turn to Daniel 3 while you're there. To build up to this, the king had made a great big golden image, and he wanted everyone to worship that image. And so whenever there was all this great fanfare of instrumentation played, the horn, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, and symphony, whenever that was played, they were to fall down and worship that golden image. But Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refused to do that. And so that was brought to the king's attention. They refused to do what you ordered that everyone should do at this appointed time. And so they go to those men, and the king is hot about this. He is bothered something awful. And so they're about to be thrown in the fiery furnace, right? Daniel's three friends in the fiery furnace, a story everybody knows. We've learned it from the time we were in Bible study on Sunday school when we were 2 years old. And so the king is pretty much saying that if you don't, verse 15, if you don't worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Now, I want you to skip down to verse 17. I want you to notice their reply. Their reply was, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. Now, see, there it is. What God? Our God. That's the one. Now, remember, in the previous chapters, the king had already learned a little bit about the God of heaven, whom Daniel served, who gave revelation of the king's dream to Daniel, and Daniel told it and the interpretation. So this is not Nebuchadnezzar's first time ever hearing about the God of Israel. But when he says, what God is God? They say, our God. But I want you to notice what they say next in verse 18. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, the answer is, our God is able to save, and he will. But if he decides not. Now, I want to point out something very strong right there. I think we could always affirm with great certainty, conviction, and faith that our God is able. You know, I was talking to, is Brother Guy here? Somewhere? Hey, there he is. Okay, I see you now. I was talking to Brother Guy last night, and I was asking him how his brother was. And I was talking to Bart and asking how one of your elders who fell ill Sunday, and the paramedics came to get him. And, you know, what was interesting about that conversation is then, now something might have changed between last night when we spoke and today, but they said, you know, they didn't find a thing wrong with him. Now, there's a part of us as humans that go, well, that bothers me, because what happened doesn't just happen for no reason, right? I mean, the human side, those of you who are in the medical field, that's probably what you're thinking. You're like, well, now, we've got to look deeper. There's something there. You don't just, you know. But one of the remarks that I made to Brother Guy, I said, you know what I think? I think the prayers of the church availed, and God took care of it. If the medical community never finds a thing, doesn't matter, because God took care of it. Did we not invoke and supplicate to our Heavenly Father on His behalf? And don't we believe that God answers prayers? I do. I do. Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes the answer is no. But no's as much an answer to a prayer as yes is, isn't it? You know, I talk to Christians sometimes, and they will say that God has answered our prayers. And usually they say that when they had a situation, they prayed for something specifically, and God saw it through how they wanted it seen through. But now, if God doesn't give it how I want it, God still answered my prayer. And sometimes when God tells me no, it's because, well, I just have to realize he's all sovereign, in control, and he knows all the facts of the case, whereas I'm only able to see what's right in front of me. That's why I believe the Apostle Paul said, and we'll focus on this tomorrow night, for we walk by faith and not by sight. But having said that, if God doesn't give me what I want, though I know He is capable of all, God is still God. And these men said, our God is able to save us, but if He doesn't, we're not going to worship that image. We are not going to do it. Are you willing to face the harshness of life and not see the hand of God in the circumstances and still be true to Him? You know, Job, when he was facing his ordeal, I really feel for Job. He lost a great amount. If you look at all the servants, all the livestock that he lost a business, really, if we talk in our terms today. And he lost his children, too. And I made the point to someone in conversation. I said, you know what I noticed is that Job didn't begin grieving and tearing his clothes and throwing the ash until word reached him that his children had died. You know, maybe Job was thinking, you know, I can handle losing materials. I can handle losing servants. But when he lost his children, that's when he expressed his grief. But you get to Job 15, and one of the things that he says, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Now here he is going through everything that he's going through, praying to God, talking to his friends who weren't all that friendly, if I can give my opinion on the matter, not knowing why this has happened to him. And he said, if God slays me, I'm still going to trust him. You know, it's easy to have faith when things go our way, but when the tide turns and it doesn't go how we want to, now you know what your faith is made of. Now you know how much you love God. Then you will know just how much you trust Him. And these guys are facing their last breath. And it's not going to be a nice, quick, easy death. It will be an agonizing, torturous, painful death if they get in that furnace. But they know with certainty that our God is able, but if He chooses not to, we will not compromise. We will continue to be steadfastly faithful to Him and not worship this image. If you were to give a good description of the book of Daniel, the description I would give would be no compromise. Because here they are in the midst of an idolatrous society. Here they are receiving an idolatrous pagan education. Here they are surrounded by everything that is not God approved. But yet they are the salt and they are the light that God wants them to be. The last example I want to point you to is in Daniel 6. Daniel 6. Daniel, by this time, is given a promotion. He's way up in the ranks, and when you do well, sometimes people don't like the fact that you've done well. And his peers in his career, they didn't care for how well he was doing and how he was succeeding. And here's what they say, verse 4. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Now here he is having pretty much what you could say is very nearly a pagan job. He is head of all the astrologers and the magicians. But he's faithful to God, and by being faithful to God, he's doing a good job for the pagan king. There's a proverb that says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies be at peace with him. One of the things that people struggle with today, Christians, is they want to please everybody. I gave that up a long time ago. And the reason I became a preacher, and I just learned I couldn't do it. Because you please someone over here, someone back there is mad because of what you did. So then you try to please them and you tick off the person that you started out trying to please. And before too long, everybody's in there and you've just made everybody upset. Best thing to do, live to please God and let everybody else get in line. Best thing to do. Because when you stand before the Lord on judgment day, it's going to be you and Him. It's not going to be you and public opinion. It's going to be you and Him. But I want you to notice verse 5. These men said, we shall not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him, what? Concerning the law of his God. Now, if I were to be accused of a crime, and if there was enough evidence to convict me as guilty, there are a few crimes I wouldn't mind being found guilty of. One of them is that I love my wife. If someone said the only way we can get something on Stephen is we've got to prove that he loves his wife, it'd be a close case. You'd have boatloads of evidence on that one. I would be guilty. Loving my children. Boatloads of evidence. He'd be guilty. Loving my country. Plenty of evidence. I'd be guilty. But let me ask you, is there enough evidence to convict you guilty of loving God? Think on that. Is there enough evidence right now to convict you guilty of loving God? Can your coworkers, can your supervisors, can your peers, can your family, could they be used to build a case and say, that person loves God? Is there enough evidence? Because the only way they could get Daniel, it had to be in relation to the law of his God. That tells you what kind of person that he was. He was a person who loved the Lord. He was a person that was faithful to the Lord. And so what they do, they watch Daniel. They keep an eye out on him. They see what he does. And they go to the king and they say, King, for 30 days, now you'll see this, 30 days, where is this? Verse 7. For 30 days, everybody in authority should petition you, the king, and no other man, and no other God, for 30 days. Now, here's Christian thinking sometimes today. I think I could hold out for 30 days. I think maybe for 30 days I could let go of some of the practices of my Christianity. After all I got to do is just make it 30 days, and then I'll kick it back up again. You go, well, now, Stephen, we'd never say that. I'm going to tell you, some of you do. You say, well, we're going on ball tournament, playing ball all day Sunday. It's just one Sunday. You go on vacation for a week. Well, we're going to be on vacation. It's just one week, one Sunday, one Wednesday night, just one week. I've had college kids come out there to Lehman. They've tried that. They go, I'm busy with homework. I'll do my best to be here, but I'm busy with homework. And I've had some say, you know, right now it's crunch time, it's finals time, I got the essays, I've got the papers, I've got the tests, everything that I have to do. As soon as I get through this time, I'm going to come back. There are some things you just never put on hold. And loving God and being faithful to Him should be number one. Always. I'd much rather be found with my brethren on a Sunday than to be anywhere else. And I'm going to tell you something. People know that on Sundays, Stephen will be with the church. And you say, well, you're a preacher. You're supposed to be. You know, they could have said that before I became a preacher. Because Sundays, we'd go on Sunday morning, we'd go on Sunday night. Wednesdays, we'd be there. Before I was preaching, I worked in insurance restoration. And there's one Wednesday night, I was walking right into the church, and one of the homeowners that I was caring for called me, and he had worked all day, and this was the time that he had to talk, and he wanted to talk. And I kindly told him, Mr. So-and-so, I said, I'm about to walk into church. I said, I'll be glad to call you when I'm out. I said, but from 7 to 8 p.m., I said, I'm meeting with the church, so I can't talk right now. And I'll be honest with you, if he would have called and ranted and raved, and if my employer would have gotten mad about that, I said, fire me. Because if you fire me for this, I know the Lord will take care of me. I will not, under any circumstance, put God on hold for anything in this world. When we go to vacation, one of the first things we do is we get out that big old directory and we look and we go, okay, here's where we're going. Let's look at where's the church is. Where are we staying? How close is the church? When do they meet? That's where we will be that Sunday. If we're traveling on Sunday, all right, we're going to leave early enough so that we can stop somewhere along the way and we're going to worship. We will not put God on hold. Daniel could have very well said, for 30 days I will not pray to my God. But I want you to notice what happens, verse 10. When Daniel knew that the writing was signed, as soon as this was made law, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. He could have put his faith on hold for 30 days, but when he knew that law had been signed in defiance of the laws of man, he went and he prayed. He did this every day. And let me be, if I may, so bold as to say that sometimes we make a big deal out of Sunday. Sometimes we make a big deal out of Sunday. Sometimes we think we're doing God a favor by being here. Or we're doing the preacher a favor. But Bart, you ought to be pleased that I'm here on Sunday night. Sunday morning, okay, everybody should be here. Sunday night, you should be pleased. Guess what? It doesn't do anything for me if you're here, if you're not here. It's between you and God. And if we talk about how bad our society is, we're part of the problem. If our society had more mamas and daddies that said, no practice, no games on Sundays or Wednesdays, we'd be better off. When I was a kid, Sundays and Wednesdays, never had a game, never had a practice. Because people knew folks went to church on those days. And if you're one of those who've compromised on it, and if I've hurt your feelings, let me ask you, is there enough evidence? Is there enough evidence to convict you guilty of loving God? I don't suspend loving my wife for any day. I tell you, I hate Valentine's Day. Stephanie will tell you that I hate it too. Ever since we've been together, I've hated it. I have said, I don't need society to tell me when I need to love my wife. Now, if some of y'all make a big deal out of it, that's fine. You're married to your husbands, not to me, so you can feel sorry for my wife if you so choose. But I don't suspend loving my wife or loving my children for anything, and I'm certainly not going to suspend loving my God for anything or anybody. If we are to be the salt and the light, the world has to see that God is a priority in our lives. And I know He is in yours, otherwise you wouldn't be here tonight. Maybe this is more of what some would say, that should have been a Sunday morning kind of sermon. But you know what? Take it with you. And sometimes people don't need to be preached at, they just need to see a good example. When my wife and I were real young and first married and had our daughter, she was a little baby, you know, I mentioned to you that she, my wife, was brought up Roman Catholic. And so all you had to do was go to Mass one day a week, and that was it. Well, and I started going, she was a Christian at this time, but I was going to Sunday morning worship, and I try to get her to come with me on Sunday night, and she's just like, no, I went this morning, I don't have to go back tonight. I'm like, okay. I didn't, you know, guilt trip her, I didn't come down hard on her, okay. Well, I kept going. Now, I could have just said, well, she's not going, I can sit at home with her. But I kept going. And then I started taking our little girl. I did that about 2 times, and she started coming. And now, I don't know if you feel this way, but when I miss a Sunday or a Wednesday, my whole world is turned off. I'm like, what in the world is happening? I don't feel right the rest of the week. You know? We have a remarkable opportunity in our climate today, as Christians, as people who love the Lord, to let the world know it. And we do it more so, I believe, by being firm in our convictions and kind about it and steadfast in what we do as Christians, more so than preaching, yelling, protesting, and boycotting. Now, you can get results with those, I realize. But Daniel and his friends never did any of those. They kept on being faithful to God. And they kept on, they were given opportunity, chance after chance, promotion after promotion, because they saw what they were doing as a service to God first. Now, you may think sometimes that the only way you can really serve God is to have a title in a church, or maybe even be on the payroll. I'm going to tell you something. If you are a public school teacher, God is going to use you in that classroom. If you are a banker, God is going to use you where you are. Whatever you do, be a Christian where you are, and don't think about the person that's over you as your boss. Do the work as if God has hired you to do it. And where you are, be the salt and be the light. You'll make more change. You'll influence more lives just by being faithful to God than anything. I promise you. So I want to, as we prepare to have an invitation, I want to ask you a few questions. And you think on these. It may not be answered swiftly. But question number one, have you compromised on the small things? Have you let this or that go, here or there? Question number two, are you willing to trust God if He does take you and deliver you to the fire? Question number three, is there enough evidence to convict you as being guilty of loving Him? If you find that in any of those questions that your answer is not what you want it to be, let us serve you somehow. Let us pray with you, pray for you, whatever we can do. Come forward right now while we stand together.